From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour is found in tragedy, in the recent double murder and suicide in Geneseo. And by now, you probably know the basic facts. 24-year-old Colin Kingston of Geneseo had dated 21-year-old Kelsey Anisi for 3 years. They had recently broken up. He had told friends he was distraught. He bought a large knife, and police say that in the early morning hours of a January day, he went to the house where his ex-girlfriend lived. He found her with another man, 24-year-old Matthew Hutchinson, and he stabbed them both to death. He called his father to confess what he did, and then he killed himself. This hour, my wish is not to dwell on that tragedy, but to discuss more broadly the questions surrounding mental health, relationships, breaking up, and more. I don't know every detail about that case, and the last thing I want to do is to make any false assumptions. The families of the victims are devastated, and they don't need me or anyone else prolonging their grief. So let me just say that we are all shocked and saddened by what happened in Geneseo. If someone listening knew the victims, please understand that we want to have a productive discussion this hour about mental health, about helping others who might be at risk in the future. So I will ask some questions about the Geneseo case with our guests, but only in an attempt to contextualize and to improve our understanding of the issues involved. Because sadly, Kelsey Anisi and Matthew Hutchinson are not the only ones who will be victims of this kind of violence this year. Let me welcome my guests in studio. Dr. Michael Scharf is here. He's the Division Chief for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UR Medicine and a consulting psychiatrist at the College at Brockport. Dr. Scharf, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also here is Sarah Shipley, a wellness education programmer at St. John Fisher College. Sarah, nice to have you as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Pamela Graham is here, prevention, education, and training coordinator with the Willow Domestic Violence Center of Rochester. Pam, nice to have you back here.
Thanks so much.
Well, let me just start, Dr. Scharf, again. We're not going to try to analyze the people involved because we don't have all of the information. But there has been a lot written already by people who are, I think, in some ways angry, saddened, shocked, all kinds of emotional reactions here. And I just want to read a couple of things that have been out there in the last couple of weeks here about this case here. This is Megan Murphy writing for Feminist Current Online in a piece called Not an Act of Love. And she writes, quote, "What we are to believe, in case it's unclear, is that love caused this man to kill a woman. This is a message we hear so often. It probably seems reasonable to many, but it's not reasonable. Men do not kill out of love. They kill out of a desire to control. If I can't have you, nobody can, is a common refrain we hear from abusive men, and often they mean it. Every day, 3 women are killed by their abusive partners or ex-partners. It is known that women are in the most danger of injury or violence when they leave or try to leave their abusers. Are we to believe that these men are killing their ex-wives or girlfriends because they are heartbroken or just distraught over a breakup? Or can we tell the truth and say that men kill their partners because they want power over these women, because they want control, because they believe in they own their wives and girlfriends?" End quote. And in the Democrat and Chronicle, Dave Andriotta wrote, quote, "Broken hearts alone don't drive people to murder. If that were the case, high school campuses would be killing fields, and they are not." End quote. What do you make of what you hear there, Dr. Scharf?
Well, I think the numbers that were quoted are not really controversial at that point. They've been confirmed and looked at many different times and over time. The conclusion about control and anger, the reality is every individual case is different. There are some common themes, but I don't think it's possible to make one universal statement of every act of violence or reactions, even in grossly abusive relationships.
Okay. And in this case, again, we don't know all of the details. We know there was a breakup.
Correct.
We know someone, friends have reported that Colin Kingston was distraught, talking about suicide, probably sadly common in some cases that lead to violence, suicidal sort of thoughts and ideations.
Correct. Yeah, I really can't comment on this case, not only for the reasons you articulated, but I don't really know enough to comment on this specific case. But the reactions people have in response to any adversity, but specifically in the context of a breakup, are often extreme. Their whole life and their development of who they are, how they deal with conflict, how they deal with loss, contributes to how they react. And sometimes that includes sense of control, sense of acting out in anger after a loss. Sometimes when people are in despair, they run through a lot of different things in their mind. You mentioned suicidal thoughts, suicidality, that'd be a concern as well.
Is there any Because most people and go throughout their lives and they go, they are in and out of several relationships at the very least. So a breakup is not at all uncommon at a college campus or elsewhere. And the vast majority of human beings don't kill or get violent over it, even as difficult as it can be emotionally. Is there any common thread that we know of through research that would indicate the people who do end up committing acts of violence after a breakup?
Well, I'm again reluctant to generalize for a single response,
that's
but the your point is really an important one. As we focus on such a tragedy, the reality is people do have breakups, and there are not reactions like this a lot of the time. I would restate the point I made that people's background of how they deal with adversity, how they deal with conflict, is violence something that's been role modeled in their life, and it's a way they've dealt with conflict before. Those are the kind of things that you could see in advance or contribute to how one reacts with a new breakup. And when we're talking about people who are younger, you referred to high schools, and for many even in college, it's often their first relationship. So even though they might go on to have a life of many breakups, the first one is always different.
Okay, that's a good point. Pamela, in this case here, David Andreatta in the Democrat and Chronicle also wrote that his concern in the sad tragedy in Geneseo is that people in danger in relationships, often women, he wrote often women, but I know you're going to help us understand the statistics.
Yes,
but,
I will.
But Dave wrote, his concern is that there are women out there who want to get out of relationships where there's either been abuse, and we don't know in this case, in Geneseo, we don't know that there was any abuse. We don't know at all. At least I certainly don't. But Dave's concern is women want to get out of relationships. They're scared to. They see something like this, and they think, I can't get out. I'm at risk.
Well, the thing that we need to remember as a society as a whole, first off, we have a personal right to break up and move on for relationships. Mm-hmm. I think we're brought up in a society today that says if we're in an unhealthy relationship, and by the way, that's where people lie and cheat like a card player, right? Unhealthy things happen to healthy people, and we'll always have a personal right to have a healthy response when those things happen, correct? Well, the thing about dating and domestic violence is what we know about survivors, 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men at this point. So as a society, we need to get better at supporting each other and asking each other what we feel like we need in order to be safe. We're under the fallacy that people break up from dangerous relationships, and they don't. See, people who are abusive don't leave. They don't go away. So people who are surviving dating domestic violence situations, they don't break up. They escape. We break up from unhealthy ones, and it takes us 6 months to a year, maybe longer, to heal from that. But everybody does because, Evan, like you said in the article, it said if breaking up was the reason why people got killed, college campuses would be empty. Well, the world would be barren because it happens to all of us. So, but what we know about dangerous relationships is once they start, the more they have, the worse they get. They don't start until there's a commitment. So survivors know what they got. They're just not trusting us to tell us. And not only that, the people that they trust so much turned out to be a nightmare. So it's subtle. Once it starts, the more it happens, the worse it gets. It ends at physical abuse. It does not start there. But that's when we all start paying attention. So the verbal abuse, the emotional abuse. I mean, abusers gain the power and control by the first threat. I love you so much, I don't know what I'd do without you. If I can't have you, nobody else is. That's a game changer for every survivor that they know they're no longer in healthy, but in a dangerous
one. You mean once that's actually articulated?
Yes, and they might be subtle. So that might be once there's a commitment, once the threats start, the more they happen, the worse they get. So an abuser gains the power and control with the threats. They follow through with the power and control by maintaining those threats. And that instills enough fear in every survivor that they know it, they're in over their head. So we have to be in a place that, first off, that they can trust us and that we're not going to disclose anything to the world that will make them in greater danger.
Okay, so hold on, Pam. Let me, two things here. And I'm going to keep doing this hour, but I think it's important to do it. Once again, Pam isn't saying, and no one is saying, that we know, based on the Geneseo case,
we don't know about that
Colin Kingston said anything like that to Kelsey and Isi.
No, we don't.
We certainly don't
but
know.
But what we know about dating violence situations, those threats or promises, dating or domestic violence.
So what's step one? If you're on the receiving end of a comment, if the person you're with says, I could never live without you, and no one else could have you but me.
Don't be alone. Give a place like Willow a call.
Be willing to call.
if you can, and if it's safe for you, just give Willow a call in our hotline at 585-222-SAVE, and we can start to have a conversation about what that threat means. Because threats are non-existent in unhealthy relationships. They exist in dangerous ones. And as a society, we need to be acutely aware of what danger is.
Okay. And you know, again, as Dr. Scharf has been saying, every relationship is different. Every case that ends up in some kind of violence is going to be slightly different than the next year. But if someone is saying that to their partner, if I can't have you, no one will.
Then that's a true threat.
That's a real threat.
That would instill true fear in us to a survivor that they know that they will be in over their heads.
Is that a moment? Is there any going back to a healthy relationship? Once that's an unhealthy relationship.
No. See, once it starts, the more it happens. So portal in is healthy, but you can't be a little bit pregnant. So once it's in dangerous, how we respond, how we support, and how we listen to survivors is going to be really important, because every dangerous relationship has its own danger level based on the lethality level of the abuser in it. That means what worked over here might get somebody killed over here. So who's the expert here? Evan, it's going to be the one person surviving their dangerous relationship.
Are you worried, as Mr. Andrietta wrote, that some people could see a case like what happened in Geneseo and think it will be too dangerous to leave? Does that worry you?
Well, every decision a survivor makes is based on not only their own safety, but their safety of their friends, their coworkers, the people they go to school with. So it's really starting to support a survivor enough that they feel safe to say, oh, this is what's going on. And then we ask, what do you feel like you need to be safe, and how can we support you? You know, these are the people who don't show up for class. These are the people who miss work. These are the people that we think are noncompliant with the world, and there's a reason why that noncompliance is happening.
Okay. Before I turn to Sarah, I just want to ask one more question on the subject of mental health here, because Joe writes to us on Twitter. It says, Evan, a very important topic, and thanks for having someone on the panel who can speak directly to mental health. That's Dr. Michael Scharf. Joe raising the mental health aspect of this discussion. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Scharf, you know, when we talk about school violence, school shootings, when we talk about, violence on a college campus, it often feels like in retrospect people say, well, let's just fix mental health and that will fix it, as if, you know, there's one thing you can do. But what I wanted to ask you is, even in that light, if somebody commits an act of violence like we saw in Geneseo, is that ipso facto evidence that there is a mental health illness that might have been undiagnosed? Or can you be mentally healthy and still get to a point where you can hurt somebody? Because some people will say, well, anybody who goes into a school and shoots has got mental illness. Anybody who goes into a workplace and shoots has mental illness. And I see conflicting opinions in the professional field on that.
Well, I think that there's a sort of a reality reaction about the intensity of a behavior, like if you go into school and shoot, for example, or if you actually commit homicide or another severe violent act. So it may feel like splitting words or a bit academic, but the way we currently define psychiatric illness or mental disorders, we use a defined set of criteria that includes some level of functional impairment as part of the definition. So someone could have an act of violence occur, they could perpetuate an act of violence without having met criteria for a psychiatric disorder. It does raise the question, though, when something is this severe, is that really realistic? Is it really possible? So if you're asking me in a literal sense, not necessarily, but the reality is when we look at cases as they become, you know, we get more information, it usually is the case.
And what kind of mental illnesses are we talking about? I mean, obviously, psychopathy could be in there, but what else?
Yeah, well, if we're talking specifically about violence, conduct disorder, history of violence, and whether it meets a specific diagnosis, but just a history of using violence as a way to resolve conflicts and seeing that as acceptable is often part of the background. Past behavior is often the best predictor of future behavior. And then a crisis, and it could be in the context of having multiple traumatic events or adversity in one's life, or it could be a single event that's particularly catastrophic. When someone is depressed, their options that they see for themselves, part of the definition is a lack of hope, a lack of seeing options for themselves. And so they feel like they have less options, less choices, and may revert to things that are, we could call more primitive, but specifically we're talking about violence right now.
Sure. And Pam is saying that in relationships, we were talking about how to help someone who might be a victim.
Mm-hmm.
Is our society getting any better at helping people not become violent, who may be prone to violence for various reasons?
Well, there too, I think there's a couple different ways to answer that. Is there more known about it? Are there specialists who work with perpetrators? There are. So there are more options for interventions, and there's more data about responding to abusers. Pam spoke very well and eloquently about defining abusive relationships and distinguishing that from unhealthy relationships. There's also data, though, when it's first relationships, so we're talking about teenagers. Sometimes people with developmental disabilities with really delayed social skills, you know, treating their loved one in a controlling or even violent manner is what was role modeled to them, and there may be hope of redirecting them. I don't want to confuse that with saying the relationship's okay. It's not. But there are when it gets to a point where there's any level of threat involved, I would agree with everything that Pam said. But if the parties get separated, there are things we can do to try to help the abusers in those situations.
Okay. Let me bring in Sarah Shipley, a wellness education programmer at St. John Fisher College. And Sarah, not licensed as a mental health counselor.
No.
So your role on campus is to do what?
It's very broad. It's generally prevention, outreach, education, presentations around all areas of wellness. So again, every day is different. But mainly my role, I work within the Department of Campus Life. So I'm very present, very in the thick of it on a day-to-day basis. So oftentimes I'm a connector to other resources on campus, other departments, off-campus resources for students that are struggling in all, in any area, really. So that doesn't really answer your question, but
no,
it answers many questions.
I think it does. I mean, it sounds to me like you're someone on campus, you want students to feel comfortable coming to
Absolutely.
You for a variety of reasons, because they need people that they feel like they can turn to. And, you know, I'm not asking you specifically, I'm just going to ask you broadly. Mm-hmm. I suspect students come to you for a variety of emotional
Absolutely.
Crises and relationship issues.
Absolutely. Because I'm kind of in a department that is very centralized, you know, students run into me every day. My office is always open for students who might wander in or wander by. I'm approachable and available. So students, you know, run things by me or they make comments or, you know, I'm often in classrooms doing presentations for first-year students or, you know, late-night programming, et cetera. So I often get comments and questions and all sorts of things from students.
And probably a lot of first real relationships, first intimate relationships, mm-hmm. where it feels like the world is that relationship.
Absolutely.
And I think we've all been there. But in general, you can turn and pivot and find resources for them if need be. And
Absolutely.
And that happens?
Absolutely, all the time. And I think what's an interesting thing to remember here is we're talking specifically about violence, but anytime a student is experiencing turmoil or stress in any way, it manifests in all sorts of forms: self-harm, eating disorders, you know, stress, anxiety, alcohol, and other drugs. So, you know, yes, some people might turn to violence in a sense, but these relationship issues can manifest in all sorts of forms as well. So it's about asking those questions. How are you doing on a daily basis? How's your relationship? How are you doing in your classes? Pam speaks about that all the time, making sure we're checking in with students and those saying those questions.
And again, asking generally, Pam, you've worked with Sarah and occasionally been there with some professional help as needed?
Yeah, we have a beautiful working relationship with St. John Fisher College. Sarah has organized presentations with athletics. We're doing the student government. We've had the student conduct. Public safety has been trained for dating and domestic violence on just having the conversation and knowing the difference between a healthy, unhealthy, and dangerous relationship. So it's really been, you know, the biggest stat that I've seen lately is that from Break the Cycle, they came out saying 58% of college students, when they were polled, don't know how to help a friend. And as Willow, as is our foundation on being the upstream of prevention of dating and domestic violence, because dating and domestic violence 100% preventable. This is stuff that shouldn't be happening, so we're not going to be able to do it until we can get out there and really have the conversation. And that's the beautiful part of having our relationships with the local colleges here.
You're hearing Pamela Graham, the Prevention Education and Training Coordinator for Willow Domestic Violence Center of Rochester. Sarah Shipley's here, Wellness Education Programmer at St. John Fisher College, and Dr. Michael Scharf, who's the Division Chief for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UR Medicine and a consulting psychiatrist at the college at Brockport. And we're talking about mental health. We're talking about healthy relationships, unhealthy relationships, you know, the first big breakups. And yes, this is in the wake of what happened in Geneseo. We're not trying to analyze every detail of that case. We're trying to talk broadly about these issues. And if you want to weigh in, we'd like to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255. Or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Rick sends an email to the program and says, Evan, I think you're being too kind to men here. In general, it feels like men do not do a good job of being on the bad end of a breakup, especially in the younger years where they feel like they are the owners in the relationship. They are the possessors. And he said, whether or not that's what happened in Geneseo, we need to talk specifically about teaching men how to break up and get dumped, because that's what concerns me most as a parent and a man. That's Rick. So Pamela, go ahead.
So as a society, if we move towards a place of more gender neutral thoughts on stuff, we'll serve each other better. Again, back to the stats of dating and domestic violence, 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men. So if we stay in the realm of gender neutralizing, part of our prevention program is to really talk about unhealthy relationships. We come from a society that unhealthy is a place of failure, and it is not. But it's also the place we give the worst advice. So, you know, when I support people 13 to 18 and 19 and over, and I say, have you ever thought about breaking up? Oftentimes I hear, I get told to fix it. I get told to settle. I get told to hope for it to get better. Mm-hmm. I get told, you know what? You know, if you're going to break up, say it's not them but you. So here's the deal. We need to get good at breaking up in this society. We need to support each other in doing that. And when we break up and move on from unhealthy relationships.
Or escape, as you said.
Well, right. No, that's dangerous. So let's keep it
escape
clear.
Escape from danger. Okay. All right, very
so
good.
We escape
very
from
good.
Dangerous relationships, but the unhealthy ones, we got the personal right to break up. We shouldn't be with somebody who we're just, that relationship is just not for them. And whether they're breaking up with us or we're breaking up with them, we all have the personal right. But we need to teach each other to do this with dignity and respect. We can't go to the internet and annihilate a former intimate partner, because then you're not getting in the college you want, and you're not getting the job you want. So we need to say, this relationship's just not for me, but we take care. We survive these. 6 months to a year, teens and people 19 and over are happy, because I see them. They'll go, Pam, guess who I saw? Who'd you see? I saw so-and-so. How was that? It was happy. Well, that's so great. Are you getting back together? No, they're exactly the same, but they're not my problem anymore. So really, we have to lift up that breaking up and moving on is a success, not a failure. For every unhealthy thing that happens to us, we will have the personal right to have a healthy response.
But you know, I grew up before the Facebooks of the world and the social medias of the world, and so I can't always relate to what a high school or a college student is dealing with now, because sometimes it feels so public. It is public. And it feels much more public than what we...
So people have a right to their privacy. We shouldn't be spinning stuff that's going on in their people's lives. We shouldn't.
So do we have to teach that in the schools?
Yeah, we do.
And you do.
It sounds strange. Doesn't it sound strange that Willow Domestic Violence Center actually goes out and talks about healthy relationships?
I don't think that sounds strange at all. I mean,
so
I think that's great.
A big thing on our stuff is teaching each other to break up, because you don't have to fix it. You don't have to settle. You get to move on. And when we get over here, so when we do the whole check-in thing, because our big thing is that we check in because of all the things that are going on with Facebook, Twitter, and I get more students coming up to me going, Pam, I'm worried about my friend. I haven't seen them in a month. And I say, are you in the same campus? Are you in the same school? And they'll go, well, yeah, but I follow them on Twitter. I follow them on Facebook. So it's checking in every day and saying, how is it? How's home? How's school? How are your friendships? How's your relationships? Not so good. Meet me after class. Let's go for a walk. Let's grab a burger. And then ask, how's it going? You know what they say? They lie. They cheat. Just ask. Have you ever thought about breaking up? You'll know they're in unhealthy relationships when they go, I would tomorrow, but I don't even know what to say. And then supporting each other to say, this relationship's just not for me. If you say, have you ever thought about breaking up, you're going to know they're over and dangerous when they say, the last time I tried to break up, it was a nightmare. The last time I tried to break up, they said, I can't have you. Nobody can have you. And then we ask, what do you feel like you need to be safe and how can I support you?
Okay. Dr. Scharf?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think as we're hearing and as I'm listening to Pam's comments, we tend to put it immediately from the role of usually woman, but predominantly the person who's feeling trapped and wants to break up. But I know that part of the teaching about healthy relationships is also teaching how to take it when someone breaks up with you.
Yeah.
And I think that actually partially answers the comments by Rick. The, you know, the reaction of wanting to be, we're not being hard enough on men. I get that. I get that in an intuitive, emotional way. But I think part of the solution to change our culture is not to wait till something happens, but to educate men in an absolutely nurturing and a supportive way about this is what relationships are like. And when
they're
you have
equal.
A disappointment, this is how you deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. They're equal. Each person is equally as important. And if we go into a relationship having strong sexual stereotypes, we're already in trouble there, aren't we?
But in terms of what Dr. Scharf is saying, teaching men, you used the term teaching men. Don't we have to teach boys? Doesn't have to start with, you know, healthy relationship education?
Well,
yeah. Thank you for clarifying. That's actually what I meant. Yes,
I assume you did, because when we've talked on this program about various conversations about what's appropriate, sexual education, reproductive health, relationship building, you know, we've talked about Holland and different countries, Norway, where at 4 years old they start with healthy relationships.
Yeah,
they're not teaching sex at 4 years old, but they're talking healthy relationships.
Yeah, Willow does it.
And so Willow is doing that.
We do pre-K through third grade, and the hands are not for hitting.
But
great. Everybody gets it.
But I don't know how many schools locally are actually teaching that. If my son, I've got a son, is he going to get some kind of education that will help him understand as he gets older, here's what a healthy relationship is, and if you get dumped, we all get dumped. And you don't own anybody, and it's okay. And you know everything you just talked about, is that going to happen for him?
Well, I have the beautiful Willow has the privilege of being able to go into several schools in the city school districts and also the surrounding areas in Monroe County. We serve Monroe County, and I just have the benefit of really meeting some just absolutely committed, wonderful health teachers, and starting very early. So conversations are starting way earlier. You would be surprised the information they're getting in sixth grade health class today, and the messages that start coming out from pre-K. And we have the privilege of being woven into all those curriculums. So established stuff is pre-K to third grade, folks are having us in. Sixth grade health classes in the area are already talking about healthy friendships, healthy relationships. Eighth grade, they get it again. Sophomore year and throughout. The new law with New York State says all incoming freshmen in any colleges or university in the state have to have dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking information in their first year. So everybody's on board, but it's not to say that really terrible things are going to happen in wonderful places. And we just got to turn up our radar a little higher. So when and if the bad happens, that we're good at responding, but that prevention upstream stuff is critical.
Sarah, how are we doing with Facebook etiquette in general, for example? I'm just thrilled that my breakups, and I had silly, dramatic relationships, I'm thrilled Facebook didn't exist.
Oh, every day I talk with my friends about how grateful we are that Facebook was just kind of coming out as we exited.
Yes.
I can't imagine dealing with all sorts of things with Facebook, people knowing. And I think those check-in conversations are so much more important now, even more so than they were before, because people don't post, well, I shouldn't say people don't. Some people post about negative things that are happening, but most people want to paint a rosy picture on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. They're making it seem like their lives are wonderful day to day when really I could be like, oh, Susie's doing great. I just saw her post her family photo from dinner the other night. She must be doing awesome. But in reality, that might be a nightmare for her. And if I don't ask, I don't know. So Facebook can be hard in a lot of ways, that one particularly, but also in breaking up, you can't escape it sometimes.
I think sometimes shouldn't we be firm when we see people, even if they're our friends, if they're being nasty about a relationship breakup, shouldn't we say something? I recently was really actually heartened that a couple of two great guys who've been together for years broke up recently, and one of them jumped on Facebook and said, look, we're not going to talk the details. We're not going to drag this out. and we still love each other.
Yeah.
And the support just poured forward.
That's awesome.
It was preemptive. The support poured forward. On the conversely, we still see people jump on Facebook sometimes and are really nasty. And sometimes, even if I think they're right, I'm thinking, do you want to do this? You know, and should I say more?
You know, I think, again, that differs for everybody, whether you feel like it's your place to say something or not. We talk about being an active, supportive bystander all the time. That's kind of where we are moving in our education in all sorts of different areas. But if you see something, say something. If you're, you know, if you're seeing something that shouldn't be happening, you know, step up, say something, you know, respectfully, of course. We always talk about being kind, but you can say, hey, is this really the place that we should be doing this? Or, you know, so-and-so is a great person to me.
Yeah.
You know, saying something if you feel like, you know, oftentimes I tell people, if you do that little head tilt and you're kind of like, well, what the heck? Maybe that's an indicator that you should say something or have a conversation. Or if you have a little bit of a twinge of a man, someone should say something. Why not you? Why not you be that somebody?
All right. I'm late for a break here. We're going to come back. JR writes an email with a question just on, again, more preventive mental health So we'll get JR's question in after this short break. And if you want to weigh in, you can do that. We're talking about mental health, healthy relationships, unhealthy relationships, breaking up, and more with our panel here. It is in the wake of what we saw in Geneseo, the tragic double murder and suicide there. We're not trying to analyze that case. We're trying to talk about broader issues related to those kinds of relationships, young relationships, important moments for all of us, and we're just trying to make sure that we're having a productive discussion with you this hour with our guests here. So if you want to call the program, you can. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We'll get back to your emails right after this short break. Coming up in our second hour, we lighten things up with a look at the art world. First Friday is coming this Friday. It's the first Friday of every month, and the art world always buzzes in Rochester around that time. Well, there are some new venues, galleries showing work, and other places you might not expect to be First Friday venues, and we'll take a little tour, get into the art world next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me go ahead and get our first phone call in. Sarah in Rochester wants to weigh in, and she's up first. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, and thanks for this program. I just wanted to say that I think part of the education for people in general should be at least a small part of being able to spot people on the front end. That by the second date, you know if somebody is a borderline personality or a narcissistic personality disorder, and these are the two kinds of people who create the most trouble for others. And if you can get a sense of that without having to be clinical about it, it could forestall a lot of problems.
Sarah, thanks for the phone call. I know, Pam, you want to jump in first here. Let me first turn to Pamela Graham, the Prevention, Education, and Training Coordinator at Willow Domestic Violence Center of Rochester. Go ahead, Pam.
See, this is the thing that's really difficult, because I often hear, oh, people just go looking for dangerous relationships. Well, we don't, because people who are abusive are beautiful, gorgeous people. None of us are going to know. People who are abusive aren't going to take us out on a first date and say, hey, well, you're sitting in front of me. Here are the rules and regulations of this relationship. These are the friends I don't want you to have. This is what I want you to wear. These are the activities I want you to quit. And by the way, here's your phone. I expect you to be on call with me 24/7. If they did it on the first date, nobody would be there. It's a no-deal deal. So people who are abusive are beautiful, gorgeous people. They're not going to do that on the first date, the fifth date, the tenth date. They're strategically going to wait for until there's a commitment. So if we say, hey, how's everything going? I met somebody. That's really great. Everything okay? Everything's great. Wonderful. Because you got the personal right for a healthy relationship. Anything less than that's not okay. But sometimes things are too good to be true, and that might not be the case now. But what we know, sometimes once it starts, the more it happens, the worse it gets. So if anything changes, you can trust me. You are not going to know with people who are abusive. They're not abusive across the line. They're wonderful to the people, other people in their lives. They just feel like they have the right and the privilege. They have the power and control in their relationships. Are there diagnoses with people? Absolutely. But you're going to know about that stuff. You're not going to know the people who are abusive because they choose to do it. And we know they choose it because they weave in the love and the goodness along with the tension and the abuse. If any of us were abused 24/7, nobody would be there. But we know that they've learned it. And that's the key thing here.
Well, before I let Sarah jump back in here, let me let Dr. Michael Scharf also weigh in on that point there. He's the Division Chief for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at UR Medicine and a consulting psychiatrist at the College at Brockport. You know, Sarah's saying you can see early on if someone has these various issues. Can you?
The challenge is when you're in a romantic relationship, your own feelings, what you're attracted to, what's, you know, turning you on, so to speak, can actually impact your judgment. It's not like you're sitting outside of yourself doing a clinical evaluation of the person. And I think if we all think about our own lives, it's hard to imagine doing that in a first date situation. But having some sort of orientation as part of general education about
Red flags. Are
certain personality traits that are associated with being more difficult or more abusive, absolutely appropriate. One such program had a theme or a section titled, "Do You Really Want to Have a Kid with Him?" And I think that just remembering that has so many implications, so many things come to mind, because some of these traits might get passed on to your kids, too. So, I think that's it's a good point, but the idea of really expecting someone to do that in real life is hard to imagine.
Sarah, what do you think?
Oh, I don't disagree with it. I just wanted to raise the issue and see what your panelists had to say about it, and I thank you very much.
Well, Sarah, thank you. And I certainly wish
that. Excellent question.
And I wish that were the case. I wish we could meet someone in within 24 hours, say, and sometimes we feel like we can, but a relationship setting, as Pam says, it's different. I also fear that, as well intentioned as what Sarah's saying is here, my fear is that someone who's a victim of either abuse or feeling like they're in danger, you know, we've all heard people say, "How could I have been with this person? Why do?" But the last thing I want to do is say to someone, "How could you be with that person?" Because months or years later, it's obvious, right?
How could you not?
Exactly.
So that's a question.
Pam, how many times have people said to you, "You don't know how much they changed"? That was not the way
they used to. As an advocate, I'm just trained well enough to absolutely know that, because victims blame themselves because society blames them. You know, for years I used to work first response in local emergency rooms in the last city I worked in, and walking in there, people would automatically want to apologize. "I'm so sorry. I got to tell you. I'm so sorry. I love this person." My response as a trained advocate, it has always been, "Why would you not? See, the love's not the problem. It's the person choosing to do this. Nobody should be doing this to you, especially the one person who should be treating you the best. Survivors do not ask for this." They don't ask for it by any means. And that the strategies, the manipulations, and the ability to inflict serious bodily injury are constantly present, along with the love and the goodness and the tension and the abuse.
Yeah, all I'm saying is I don't want anybody to feel
like
you're to blame for
thought.
Just being with that
They're
person.
They're not. How would they have known? Yeah, they wouldn't have known.
Even when we may have friends who we think, "I can't believe they're with this person," but we want to articulate love and care and support, not
blame. Yeah, and that's when they're healthy, right? Yeah. And conflict happens in healthy, but you own your own stuff.
Yeah.
You don't blame the other person.
Yeah, Sarah, I mean, you deal with students who kind of come in and maybe express similar thoughts?
Yeah, and honestly, I'll be the first to tell you, in college I had a really terrible relationship that bordered on dangerous, and I didn't realize it till many years removed, and I do what I do every day, and I think about that all the time. My friends, you know, kind of got to the point where they were exhausted trying to help me, and it really wasn't their place to do so. You know, they supported me, they asked what I needed, but at the end of the day, I made my own decisions. I was, you know, stuck, and I think a lot of students feel that way. They just don't know how to help each other, what to do or what to say.
Because you were the expert and only you
yeah,
knew
absolutely.
What the threats or the promises were. And that's where we take the judgment out and meet people individually where they're at. We don't offer advice, but say, "What do you feel like you need to be safe, and how can I support you today?" And what's safe today will not be safe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that's where if we're in the middle of this equation going, "Oh, I already told them four times. I can't believe they're doing that again," then we will cease to be supportive as a community and we won't heal that way. Mm-hmm. So if we just know this is a journey. Right? What works today might not work for tomorrow, and that we are there to meet everybody where they're at to offer those options.
All right. And before I go out to Don and Brighton, one more quick point here. For all the listeners saying, "I get that. I want to be supportive. But there are moments where I want to say, I've got to be firm with you and tell you, to leave.
Okay, I love that you're saying that, because that's tough love, and this is not a time anybody feels needs tough love. That causes isolation of the survivor. We diminish the survivor, and by the way, we belittle and humiliate the survivor in the same way the abuser does in those moments. So in those times when we feel that just means we're tired. So call Willow Hotline, and we'll support you in supporting them so that stuff doesn't happen anymore, because it's not supportive.
Okay. Is it okay to say, look, I love you, I support you, but you're with this person, and I don't want to go on a double date. I don't want to go out. I don't want to go to dinner. That person, I love you, I'll see you separately. Is that a supportive way? Maybe you don't want to spend time with
their significant. It's okay for you just to say, hey, I get very little alone time with you. Is it okay if we don't do the double date? But I'm always here for you, and I would love to have coffee with you. I'd love to meet you at the student union. Nobody has to do anything they're not comfortable with, but nobody has a right to tell the other person what they need to do or to bottom line it and say, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, I'm not your friend anymore.
Yeah, okay. In Brighton, this is Don. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, well, we've been talking a lot about males abusing women, but there's some of the other. For instance, I didn't realize how much I was being verbally and mentally abused until after my wife divorced me and her friends came out and said, oh, I'm so happy you're rid of her.
Oh.
And because the way she treated you was abominable. I got that over and over and over again. So everyone. And I wasn't happy, but I didn't realize how bad it was.
Don, I'm in awe of your strength to survive all that you've survived. And again, that's why it's so important that as a society, we remember the 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men. It is going to be this close to all of us, and it's not going to be that obvious. You're safe today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she divorced me. This was 35 years ago.
Okay.
And I'm very happy. I'm with a lady now who just treats me, you know, she comes down on me when I do something she doesn't like, which I think is only fair.
Yes. Well, but, you have the personal right for a healthy.
When it's not this constant little picking and I don't know.
Yeah, walking on eggshells.
Don, thank you. Thanks for the phone call. It's a good reminder, too.
I know.
And Pam is going to keep making sure we get reminded that to be more gender neutral. I understand.
Yeah. And I think Don hit on a really important point there, is that when you're in the thick of it, you don't realize how bad it is. And people from the outside can maybe make observations and see it and get frustrated. But, you know, constantly, if you're in it, you don't realize how bad it is from day to day at times.
Yeah. I want to turn to Dr. Scharf about what's going on in the schools, but in the context of an email from Liz, and let me read Liz's email, and she writes the following. Healthy relationships start at home. There's already enough put on the schools, so that should be starting with parenting and how parents treat each other and talking about it when the kids are 2 years old, and then maybe supporting the schools, but the schools are raising kids in too many cases, and this is one thing I'm frustrated about hearing, that it's always got to be the schools. Liz, I don't disagree that it starts home. I don't think anybody in this panel disagrees that kind of modeling, you want healthy modeling from whoever's at home with kids. Absolutely agree. We're just being realistic here that there is an educational component, and I'm thinking about the kids out there who don't have good modeling at home to begin with. That already puts them in a hole. That already makes it more difficult. And then the question is, are they getting a good and healthy message at school? Dr. Scharf, we've talked about the fact that Willow will work with schools. There are these educational programs. We're heartened to hear about a lot of that. But what do you see? I mean, you probably see a wide variety.
Thank you. I do. And Liz, thank you for your call. You're making a point which is really critical. And I think I alluded to it earlier with what have people had for role modeling, what's their experience of how they've learned to deal with adversity. But you said it even more articulately than I could have. Thank you. I think it's all good for schools to provide information, but we all have been to school and had a lot of information thrown at us, and how much of it do we remember? If it's not reinforced, if there's not an environment where parents or other supportive adults, and ideally peers also, provide a layering of integrating the information, making it feel very real, having a health class where someone talks about something isn't enough. So I think your point is an outstanding one. And, you know, when we think about core traits of personalities and how people treat each other, it really does largely come from what we learn at home. And role modeling is very powerful. The role modeling that we provide for our children about relationships is sometimes the only book on relationships that they will ever read. Mm-hmm. We can't make that point strongly enough. Ideally, it's a combination. And so parents should be aware of what's going to come in the health class, try to have an idea of when it's coming, and then talk about it. And so again, this combination of role modeling, information provided by other adults in their lives, and then coming back and discussing it and saying, wow, that's just like how we do things at home. It's really powerful.
You meet males out there. I don't say just males, boys and girls, but yeah. you meet people, sometimes kids, sometimes young adults, who still have sort of, ideas about what's normal.
That's absolutely right, and that's a really important point. I see people who've attended those classes. I see people who are in college and do the same orientations that we've talked about, and they even learn the words, but it doesn't feel real because in their worldview, what they're used to, physical violence sometimes, and certainly high expressions of conflict and even control are what they've learned to be normal. Sometimes in a first relationship, if no one has talked to people about relationships, they think that whatever develops in that relationship is normal. And so really trying to help people understand what's healthy, what's unhealthy, and what's dangerous, as each being different and possible, is really, really important. But I don't think we can make the point strongly enough that some people think that these experiences are normal, and even if they've been exposed to the information, it's not in their awareness. So if we can move people's awareness, if we can help them realize some of the things Pam was saying, that everyone has a right to control their own behavior, to be in a healthy relationship, and to set limits, it's really, really important. Liz's point is an outstanding one. It does start at home.
All right. One more quick listener comment, and it came from JR earlier this hour. He just wants to get back to the question on preventive mental health services so we don't see violence. You know, that is such a complex question and so difficult. But Dr. Scharf, if we're going to get better,
yeah,
what do we do?
Well, I would, if people are really interested in this topic and learning more, the Commission on Children's Behavioral Health for the Finger Lakes, which was organized by the Greater Rochester Health Foundation, just released the report on children's mental health in our region. It was just released last Thursday. And a section of that report focuses on school programs and prevention programs that are evidence-based programs that have been associated with reductions in violence. I in my role through the University of Rochester, I was the head of a team that wrote a white paper on this topic to inform that report. So there actually is a lot of information about this, and there's inconsistent examples of schools taking it on, but not really a universal approach to utilize evidence-based prevention programs.
All right, so if I'm an administrator and I reach out to you and I want, you know, something either evidence-based or just a good idea for how we might be able to reduce violence before it even happens on the mental health side, what can we do?
Well, there's a few different programs there. It depends on the age of the school. Mm-hmm. It depends which school it is. And it depends how much resources you're willing to put into it. Generally speaking, things where we change the whole culture, where the teachers are, it's not just someone who comes in and does a talk, but the teachers all have the same orientation, the social workers, counselors, to the program, and then again make it part of the culture in the school is really what's going to be most effective. If part of our audience is school administrators that are interested in that, you can by all means give me a call and we can talk about some details.
And where's the report?
The report is, I wish I had a website.
Can we find it online?
You absolutely can. In fact, there was a story from XXI on Thursday.
I should know this. I work here.
From Beth Adams that I believe is still online and has the whole report linked into it.
And Megan Mack and I, our producer, we'll find it and we're going to post it on our Twitter account. And we'll also see if we can post a link when we podcast this broadcast. So we podcast all the shows, WXXINews.org/connections, and we'll put it up there. There, so in a couple of places, so you can check it out, whether you're a school administrator or not. I mean, I think as we get better research and more evidence, we'll slowly get better at tackling these. But obviously, we know it doesn't happen overnight. Okay, so we're just about out of time. Pam, Sarah, Michael, thank you for your time. And some final thoughts just on where to go.
Anybody needs help figuring out on how to help a friend, how to help a coworker, or if they need help themselves, Willow Hotline, 585-222-SAFE. You have a personal right for a healthy relationship. Anything less than that, not okay.
S-A-F-E-V-E.
S-A-F-E. Safe.
Safe. 222-SAFE. Okay. And Willow Online where?
Willow, yes. Yes, www.willow.org.
Willow.org. Okay. Yeah. And Sarah, I wish every campus had someone like you helping direct the students there. I know you're moving them to people like Pam,
yeah,
people like Dr. Scharf. Thanks for taking the time to
Absolutely.
Tell us about your experience as well. Dr. Scharf, great to see you as well.
Thank you.
In this ongoing conversation about mental health in our community, we hope that we turned it in the direction of some solutions this hour. Short break and more connections next.